Welcome to the Mac Observer's Daily Observations Podcast. I'm Jeff Gamet. Today is Thursday, March 17th, 2016. With me today, I have Dave Hamilton. And how are you, Dave?
I'm doing all right. I think I've got a little head cold, so I'm going to be a little foggy today, which will add a nice, unpredictable element to our conversation.
That's awesome, because like you, I'm always just along for the ride.
That's right.
Yeah. John Martellaro, how are you doing?
I'm fine. Delighted to be here.
Excellent. I'm glad to have both of you here. And I thought that today would be a good day to address things or comments from readers. So that's exactly where we're going to start. And first, I will start with an email from Jeremy. And I have a feeling if Jeremy is asking, a lot of other people might be concerned too. He asked the other day, what was wrong with Nightshade? And Nightshade is my cat and office manager. He said she seemed really upset about something. I hope she's okay. Yes, she's okay. Nightshade has just started doing this thing where she decides she wants to be on the show. And she will be quiet all day. But when I start recording, she has something to say, clearly. And does. She did the same thing on Apple Context Machine yesterday. She had a lot to say then. So yes, Nightshade is totally fine. And Jeremy, thank you for asking. The next thing that I thought was interesting or good was a question or a comment from Rick. And this goes back to a couple days ago when you two were on and we were talking about using voice recognition systems like Siri and Google Now when you're in a crisis situation. And so Rick said that, first said he thought the show was great. So that's awesome. Thank you. And he felt that we made a lot of valid points. I will now read what he's saying. There are a couple points that you might want to consider. One is speech patterns when someone is under great stress. I don't know if there are definable clues versus just a test or academic query. Also, there's another thing that might influence a situation. What if the person is wearing a smartwatch with appropriate sensors? It seems like the heart monitor and maybe other indicators could help judge what is happening with this person and if there is a valid crisis. And he also mentions maybe the accelerometer in our phones could be used to help determine if we were in a crash. What do you guys think?
Or you just fell down.
Or you just fell down? Sure.
Like my neighbor did in the previous show when I talked about that. Yeah. Well, you know, there are certain chemicals released into the bloodstream when you're having a heart attack. The first order of business is to do the heartbeat. Maybe in the future, phones will have glucose through a measurement of the sweat. I published an article about that in Particle Debris, a Scientific American article, where analyzing your sweat under the watch to get a number for the blood glucose. But there might become a day when the Apple Watch or some sort of wearable so sophisticated it can actually do a little mini lab analysis of your blood and detect whether you're having a heart attack.
Yeah, when you asked the question, Jeff, my initial thought that came to mind was the phone doesn't have enough data currently to answer that question definitively enough. Or intelligently enough. But, you know, John, that's basically the same thing you just said, albeit with a more positive spin. Maybe someday the phone will have this. Maybe someday the phone will have that. And I think that's where it needs to be before we even begin to implement a feature like this. I feel the same way I did the other day. It's just a dangerous thing. I get that we want to help, but if we can't limit the number of false alarms, false positives and false negatives, right? I mean, it's got to be both. It's got to be super accurate. And we're not there yet. That doesn't mean that Apple shouldn't be working on this and that Apple shouldn't be talking about it. And therefore, it's fine that we're talking about it. But I don't want anybody to start clamoring for this yesterday.
Because Dave, I was wondering whether there is a way to intelligently set expectations on the part of the Apple Watch and iPhone user. We talked jokingly the other day about putting this device has passed the Turing test sticker on it. But that was a sort of a humorous way of getting at the idea of setting expectations, but we never really followed up on that. Do you think there's a way, since we talk to our phones, of communicating that, hey, we aren't there yet. This device is not ready to handle your medical situation or an emergency.
I think the best way to communicate that is to not have that as part of the discussion. And I say that just having watched technology be misinterpreted so many times, right? We're geeks here. We spend the time to really answer the question, but B, we also have enough of a foundation, a pretty broad foundation and a deep foundation in all of this stuff to where we can understand what we're being told and understand the very subtle, sometimes nuances in that information. And you know, this whole brouhaha between the FBI and Apple over security and encryption that's going on in the public discussion right now is another, you know, another case of that where I would argue that the FBI is intentionally leveraging the fact that most people don't really understand what is at risk here to sway public opinion towards an opinion the public doesn't have enough knowledge to have.
Is that something the government ought to be engaged in when the government is in the process of protecting the population?
If they want to, not necessarily, but in that case, yes, because they're effectively using propaganda to mislead people intentionally. And so, you know, it's just an example. I'm not saying that Apple with health data is using propaganda, but it's the same fundamental problem that we can't expect the general population to have a deep technical understanding of all of this stuff. So until, say, the phone is truly capable in the eyes of the people that do have this understanding, then we shouldn't even be talking about, well, it can do a little bit of it. No, you know, okay, well, you just told me it can do a little bit of saving my life in an emergency. Okay, but I don't understand. That's all that, it doesn't matter how much detail we go into, the lion's share of the population is just going to say, is going to understand that in certain circumstances, my phone can help me in an emergency, therefore it can help me in all emergencies.
Let me give you an example of that. I was watching the CBS show NCIS the other night.
Yeah.
And this couple was in a Jeep out in the middle of Iraq with a driver, and there was a sniper who was after them. And the sniper took out the driver and her husband. So she jumped out of the car in plain sight and pulled out her phone and was furiously trying to get a signal so that she could call for help.
Okay.
And of course, the next bullet was on the way.
Right.
And the answer was, you know, get back inside the Jeep, pull the dead driver out of the driver's seat and get moving.
Right.
But instead, she just made herself a target by standing there with some sort of smartphone trying to call for help. So that's a classic example of a technical misunderstanding of events that lead you to make wrong decisions about your course of action.
Yeah. And I don't mean to say what I just said and imply that the population, you know, our world is full of idiots. That's not true. And it's also not what I'm meaning to say. It's just that our world is full of lots of people, most of whom don't have an interest in understanding the nuances of the technology that we have all come to rely every day. And that's okay. But we also, just because they're using, say, an iPhone or a Mac, we can't expect them to be experts at understanding how it works, right? When I was a kid, that was not the case, right? If you used a computer, it was fair to assume that you had a deep technical understanding of how that thing operated, right? Just by simply using it. And that's absurd today. People use computers all the time. I use, you know, there are things that I use that I don't have an overwhelmingly deep technical understanding of, and yet I rely upon them. That's fine. I mean, as a homeowner, I've had to learn about how my boiler works. That was sort of because I didn't want to pay someone else to learn about that. You know, and it's a fairly simple operation, actually, when you think all about it. But it was a mystery to me. I turned on the heat, and it came on until the day it didn't. And it was like, okay, do I call someone or do I go down and start trying to troubleshoot this thing? I'm a troubleshooter by nature, so it was plan B. But and then once I realized what the problem was, then I hired somebody because I wasn't, you know, skilled enough to in my mind, to fix this thing. But that's, you know, that's how...
Honey, call the plumber, damn it.
Yeah. Well, and that was the right move, right? But you know, it's helpful to understand. Just helpful because I enjoy understanding to understand. At some level.
Yeah. Well, I have a question for you, Dave, along those lines. You know, Apple's had a history of making complex technology simple to use.
Yeah.
And so when the original iPhone came out, there was this idea that phone numbers became active as text, and you would tap a phone number and it would actually dial it. And this is a classic example of Apple's brilliance in the human interface, where a phone number should be touchable, right? But over the last 8 years, the phone has become so complex, and there is so much technology in that device, with 64-bit and gigabytes of storage and baseband radios and complexities, that is the easy-to-use metaphor so strained that people misunderstand how to use their device anyway? Just a question.
That's a good question.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah.
But another part of that is that people watch television and movies. And there's a lot that we see our devices do in TV shows and movies that they simply can't do. But people see this, and it reinforces the notion that we have these all-powerful supercomputers in our pockets that can do absolutely anything. And the reality is, no, they can't, but it's a real easy tool to use when you need to make a plot move forward, and you just need a simple mechanism to make that work. You just write a scene where an iPhone can do whatever it is that you need it to do in that one scene, and then people see that and think, my iPhone can do this, my Android phone can do this.
Interesting about that is that there's more opportunity to invoke special features of your phone than people may realize. For example, workflow or if this, then that, or other apps that have to be studied a little bit before you can release their power and make them work for you. So there is that middle ground, too.
Yeah, It's true. Yeah, I think Apple's been pretty responsible over the years about waiting to introduce features. I mean, they've gotten some things wrong, and we've had some things roll out that don't work. But, you know, by and large, their MO is roll out less features that are reliable. Again, they don't always get it right, but, you know,
like AirDrop?
Oh my God. Yeah. Right. Well, again, we can find, let's do another episode. No. I mean, right. There's plenty of rant opportunity here, that directly refutes the statement I'm making, and is well deserved, but you know, their goal, they have been slower to roll certain things out. I mean, the iPhone's a great example, right? You know, it's like, all right, let's get this thing into people's hands. Let's see what they do with it. Okay. You know, copy and paste. Okay. Let's be very thoughtful. Let's learn how people interact with this device so that we can be very thoughtful about the right UI for copy and paste, right? Frustrating because we didn't have it initially, but in the end, you know, worked out okay. But, you know, that's part of the process. And I think that's where we are with this is, okay, you know, if everybody that used an iPhone was an engineer that designed the iPhone, they could have put copy and paste in the first time because everybody would have understood how to use it because they were part of designing it, right? But Apple knows that that's not the case. And the same is true of this. They start putting, I mean, they already have an emergency feature, and we talked about it the other day, but, you know, it's all it does is call 911. Well, okay, could it do more? Yes. What happens when you open, you know, Pandora's box up there? I think it's a risky thing, especially when we're talking about emergencies.
Yes, and in the case of the iPhone and making emergency calls, I think it's a very poor implementation. I have yet to see someone use it effectively.
I was thinking about that after our show the other day, because you said that, you know, no one does this, and it's because it's a completely different path to do that. I get why it's there. If you can't remember your password or whatever, you still have this emergency button. If you grab someone else's phone, you don't know their password, you still have this emergency button. That's great. But for the person whose phone it is, they're in an emergency, they're never going to stop and say, hey, there's this other path. They're going to unlock their phone the way that they have been trained to do so by rote.
That's absolutely right.
They're going to launch the phone app and dial 911. I mean, it's you're on a path. Maybe at the moment you're dialing the first one of 911, you think, yeah, you know, there's that other way. But you're not going to reverse course at that point.
No.
I was showing my wife how to do that the other night, and I was appalled by how small the text is at the bottom left of the screen. It says emergency. Should be a big red button.
Yeah, but it's not.
Yeah, it's not. But then people also would equate that with hang up.
Right? It's true. Yeah, right. Like, yeah, don't
so
make
it says
it too
emergency.
Big.
Press here to hang up.
Yeah, don't press the big red button. You know, now you see it.
Yeah,
let's make it flashing, John. Yeah.
What could possibly
go wrong?
But
that's the thing, right? It's really a tough thing. So, I don't know.
Yeah. You know, I would love to keep talking about this. I know I say this a lot because we always talk about stuff that is just so interesting. But there is something else that I wanted to make sure that we hit today, simply because I had several listeners asking me questions yesterday. And the deal is, many people were confused about what two-factor authentication really is. And they were also confused about why they would need an app like Authy or Google Authenticator. So we need to dive into that a little bit. And we should start with what will hopefully be a clearer explanation of what two-factor authentication is. And Dave, since you weren't on the show yesterday, I was thinking maybe I could put you on the spot and get your definition of two-factor authentication, so it's coming from a different perspective than what we had on the show yesterday.
Sure thing. Yeah, so correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm certain that I will be. But what two-factor authentication means to me is having two different pieces of information that are required in order to prove that you are you and to log in or otherwise clear yourself as being authorized for a given service or whatever it is, a website that you're logging into, could be your device at home, whatever that is. So a single factor authentication would be a password or a thumbprint, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or anything like that. Two-factor authentication is more than one of those things. So it could be two passwords, or it could be a password and a thumbprint, or a password and a retina scan, right? Or, you know, anything like that. That's how I see it. There's what you have, what you know. What's the third one? Why can't I think of this? This is so welcome to my
what you are.
No, what you have, what you know, and oh man, there's the third one. And now welcome to my head cold, folks.
And it's funny when someone forgets something like that, how my brain will lock up and forget it too.
And something you have would be an ID card.
Yeah, okay, so and what you are.
That's right. Something you are would be like a thumbprint.
That's right. Yes. Yeah, you're right. Your retina scan, your thumbprint, that is what you are. Correct. So a passcode, yes, something that you have would be a, like a card, a device. Wow. Yep. And something you know is a password. That's right. Yep. Thank you. Thank you.
Awesome. I like that. Okay. So now I think we need an example. So if I am using, we use iCloud because a lot of people use iCloud.
Sure.
So that relates to my Apple ID. If I turn on two-factor authentication for my Apple ID, what happens?
Right. So you go to log in using your normal username and password. So that's one factor, right? Mm-hmm. And then Apple servers say, okay, I've based on whatever their criteria is, you know, you haven't authenticated this device as one that you can log in with one factor, because there are some, right? You can say, don't do this in the future on this device, and then you can log in with just one password. But if it requires two-factor, one of two things happens. You either get a notification to one of your iOS devices that has previously been blessed by you to receive them.
Okay.
And if you do get that, then you actually have to unlock that device. So it sort of becomes three-factor at that point, right? Because it's something you have, and it's another piece of information or something that you are, depending on whether you're unlocking with your fingerprint or a passcode. And then it will display a number on the screen that you then type back into the first thing. So this is something you didn't know, right? It's something that they are saying, okay, previously you've said, if you have this other device in your possession, then that's enough to prove that you are you. So in order to prove that you have that device, something you have, we are going to send a code to it. If you have it, then you will have the code. If you don't have it, so it's their way of proving that something you have is truly in your possession without scanning a card.
Dave, tell us how to bless your phone as a trusted device.
Oh, that's a good question. I think you there's actually a number of ways to do it, right? You can do it online at iCloud.com, but I think you can also do it in your settings when you set up the phone.
When you first authenticate that sounds right. I believe you can.
When you first authenticate the phone to iCloud, you can say, do you want this to be a trusted device? Now, but here's an interesting thing. That's one way, right? So it really is the two-factor with Apple is about what you know, your password that you initially log in with, and what you have. It just so happens that to prove what you have, they're sending you another piece of information, but it's a temporary piece. That code would never work again. In fact, it probably wouldn't work 5 minutes from now. It's a transient piece of information. Mm-hmm. You don't have to bless your phone. You can bless your phone number.
And then you get a text message with the code.
And then that's right. And that can be very interesting because, you know, your texts, you might choose to bless, say, your Google Voice number, which isn't a device. It's, you know, a virtual device that might email you. So the what you have becomes a little bit more nebulous in that environment, but or in that scenario.
But now,
great explanation, Dave.
Yeah, I love that. And we are pretty much out of time. But I wanted to point out one thing that I've seen that's fairly common among different services that offer various forms of two-factor authentication is sending out a text message with a code that you must enter into whatever login form they have. So that is a pretty common thing to see.
And it is.
And just real quick before we wrap up, a couple people were asking, why would I need to use something like Authy when I'm getting text messages with these codes? And the answer to that is you can set up an app to be that other piece of information, that transient code, and have it automatically generate a code that you must enter as opposed to getting a code that comes through a text message. And in cases like that, like say if you're using Google services like your Gmail account, and you're going to use two-factor authentication there, you can have a text message sent with a code, or you can choose to use an app like Google Authenticator or Authy, and then that app gets linked to your account, and then it can generate one-off codes that last for like 30 seconds. And so instead of having to wait for a text message to come in, you open the app, you see the code for that specific service, and you have to type it in quickly because you only have about 30 seconds before it stops working. Go ahead.
I have something to add here, though, because this is essentially replacing the text message, but it's still all about the what you have. You are blessing that app on that phone to generate that code.
Right.
And if you bless the same app on another phone or on your iPad, then the first app is no longer usable for that. It's not going to generate the right codes. And that's the right way to do two-factor authentication and remain true to the cause here. However, there is an app that makes it really convenient and tears that wall down, though, at the same time, and that is 1Password. Because I can authenticate 1Password to stand in place of Google Authenticator or Authy or any of those for a variety of services. But the problem is it syncs that to all of my devices. So now it's not do you have the one phone that you authorized. It's do you have 1Password on your phone or your iPad or your Mac to generate the one code that we need. And so it's very convenient, but it really does sort of fly in the face of true two-factor authentication. And from the security benefits of two-factor authentication. Because you can know, I mean, you know, if I do it with 1Password, I've probably got 6 devices that sync to my 1Password account. Well, okay, so now it's about what I or someone else has. It's not a unique thing. It's now we virtualized it, so it's no longer unique.
Okay. I that's an important distinction. So I'm glad you brought that up.
And I know I ran us over time by doing that, but I really felt it important to throw that out there.
That's okay. It was really important. And that's a great place for us to wrap up. So we will. Dave, thank you for being here today.
My pleasure.
And John, thank you for being here as well.
My pleasure also.
And listeners, thank you for joining us. And thanks for sending in your comments and questions. I love that this gets to be a two-way relationship. That's just awesome for me. So, yeah, thanks for listening. We'll see everyone again tomorrow.